This is the podcast of the talk given to the February 2021 meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society by Dr. Stephen McInerney on Les Murray's Sacramental Poetics. The speaker is introduced by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Society. Incidentally, when explaining how the talk came about, the Gerard to whom both the President and the speaker refer is Gerard Windsor.
From the moment Les Murray died, I was very keen to have somebody come and talk to us about Les, not just for the great poet he was, and there's no question about it, he was by any criteria a great poet, an extraordinary facility with words, as I hope to remind you of in a few minutes, and as Stephen will certainly do too, but he was a poet for whom the spiritual and the transcendent were all important. And I thought that For those two reasons alone, we of the Catholic Historical Society should acknowledge his contribution to Australian religious as well as intellectual and cultural life, because music and painting and literature are all part of our history, just as much as, you wouldn't think so for the last week, but just as much as politics and money and business and sport are. So I was particularly pleased and I'm very pleased that Gerard's able to be here today, because I spoke to a couple of people and said I'm desperately anxious to get somebody good to speak to us about Les Murray, who can touch on all of those things that Les was, particularly to the Australian Catholic Historical Society. And it was Gerard who suggested that I ask Stephen. And from the very first correspondence that we had, I knew that this was the right person. So I was very anxious that we celebrate Les and celebrate Stephen's contribution as well. Now, one of my favourite Les Murray poems, and it's partly because it commemorates something that I used to walk past at least three times a week in my days of being a music critic for various Fairfax publications between 1978 and 2003, I was at the Opera House probably three nights a week. Sunlight in the evening, and I would walk past that extraordinary fig that Les commemorated in his poem, Creeper Habit. When I went to the Opera House for the first time this year, only about 2 weeks ago, I was amazed, appalled, to think that the fig that Les wrote a poem about is gone. But it was fading light, and so this morning I've been there. And the barbarians at the Opera House have killed or removed that tree as part of the renovations that they've done. A couple of years ago, I wrote to them and said, this is a very, very important plant. And in the best traditions of state bureaucracy and federal bureaucracy, they passed it on and said, oh, it's the responsibility of the Botanical Gardens. Well, that is no more. And it happened in exactly the same week as our present humbug state government said, we're going to give special attention to the cultural and heritage significance of Macquarie Street. And so the first example of that I see is a loss of the tree which gave rise to this. And it tells us something very important about poetry, I think. It tells us that poetry, like literature, isn't about the extraordinary, but it's about the ordinary made extraordinary. It requires an artist's genius, a musician's genius, a poet's genius, to see an image, to see and take an idea, and to turn it into something of precious, refined gold. And I'll read you that poem. It's not very long, in case some of you don't know it. And it's called Creeper Habit. And we're celebrating something which is no longer there. On Bennelong Point, a two-dimensional tree drapes the rock cutting. Bird-flecked, self-espaliered. It issues out of the curb, feeding on dead sparks of the old tram depot. A fig, its muscles of stiffened chewing gum, grip the flutings and beads of the crowbar and dynamite wall. The tree has height and extent, but no roundness. Crampened in cracks, its branches twine and utter coated leaves. With half its sky blank rock, it has little chance. It is climbed high from a tiny sour gall and spreads where it can, feeding its leaves on the light of North Shore windows. Now, Les was able to make poetry, as I said, out of anything. There's one poem which he called The Dream of Wearing Shorts Forever. to go home and wear shorts forever in the enormous paddocks in that warm climate, adding a sweater when winter soaks the grass. To camp out along the river bends for good, wearing shorts with a pocket knife, a fishing line and matches. Now, who would have thought you can take a pull about wearing shorts? I've been wearing them for the last 10 days down at Jervis Bay, celebrating the fact that there was little sunshine, so there's no shame in my never going into the water. But Les Murray had that gift. And it's really, and he was a country boy through and through. He lived in Sydney for a while when he was a student, and for years after he was, if anyone says, can anything good come out of Chatswood, I, as a resident of that area, can say, yes, well, Les Murray was there for a while. And he was a country boy, and that's where he died. And Stephen McInerney, who's going to be talking to us today, is another country boy, born and grew up in Kiama, where I recently drove through. And he was educated at St. Joseph's College at Hunters Hill. Didn't turn into a champion footballer, but became a poet himself and a writer. He's now the academic director of the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization, and he teaches part-time in English literature. So, and he's a very, very distinguished poet himself. He's in this same book that I've been quoting from, this extraordinary, the Blue Book, as I call it, Australian Poetry Since 1788, edited by Jeff Lehman and Robert Gray. And he has a few poems in that. So that gives us an idea of the caliber of the speaker that we've got today to begin our events for 2021. So welcome, Stephen, and I really look forward to what you have to say.
Thank you, Jack, and hello, everyone. Thank you for inviting me, Jack, and James, for putting up with me with editing the essay for the next edition of the journal. And thank you, Jared, for recommending to Jack that I give this talk. I'm really talking about just one aspect of Les's work, and as far as possible, am using examples from interviews and articles where he talked about his work through this prism of the sacramental. It is, I hope, not a narrow way to view his work, but of course one becomes aware as soon as one begins to look through a certain lens at any work, but particularly of Les, that even that term sacramental is inadequate to describe his work, though I think it was a term he chose precisely because it points to the conjoining of the infinite with time. I want to begin just by setting what Les said about his own work as sacramental in some sort of historical context. I won't go further back really than, not very far back at all really, than the 19th century. In his lectures on poetry, John Keble, the Anglican poet and priest, declared that poetry lends religion her wealth of symbols and similes. Religion restores them again to poetry, clothed with so splendid a radiance that they appear to be no longer symbols, but to partake, I might almost say, of the nature of sacraments. Almost 50 years later, Matthew Arnold argued that since the fact had failed it, the strongest part of religion was the unconscious poetry of its rites and rituals. 100 years later still, the English novelist and philosopher Iris Murdoch declared that art and poetry fill the void left by sacraments and prayer in an unreligious age. Yet while Murdoch was paradoxically equating art and sacrament at the very same time as she was sounding the death knell of religion, the Catholic painter and poet David Jones was coming to the end of a career that had been devoted to reconnecting art with its ancient roots in sacramental practice. Persuaded by Jacques Maritain's extraordinary claim that the Eucharistic sacrifice is at the heart of poetry, Jones related art to the sacramental life with a sophistication and depth that exceeded any before him. For Jones, the sacraments themselves were a form of craftsmanship by which the work of human hands becomes an incarnation of the divine. He first relates the Eucharist to painting. As the body and blood of Christ are said to exist under the species of bread and wine, it's a horrible expression, species, but under the species of bread and wine respectively, so a painted object or scene really exists under the species of paint. And as through and by the Son, all creation came into existence and is by that same agency redeemed, so we who are co-heirs with the Son extend in a way creative and redeeming influences upon the dead works of nature when we fashion material to our heart's desire. Poetry too for Jones is subsumed into the Eucharistic sacrifice, where the poet working at his poem is compared with the priest at the altar making this thing other. Contemporary literary criticism has also borne witness to the increased awareness of the relationship between poetry and sacrament, giving rise to something of a minor genre in critical discourse. And this is particularly noticeable in the scholarship surrounding the work of Gerard Manley Hopkins, where some extraordinary claims have been made about his own intentions for his poetry. Maria Lichtman, for example, has argued that the poem for Hopkins is the body of Christ. It is the Eucharist in the sense of bearing the real presence of Christ, of acting with sacramental, transforming instress on the reader, as Hopkins has himself instressed nature. Eleanor McNeice is equally daring in her claim that Hopkins crafts a poem as a kind of mass in which all the words work to voice the one word, Christ. The successful poem, she says, enacts the Eucharistic process. The moment of sacrifice is the culmination of real presence in the reader. Margaret Ellsberg, meanwhile, has argued that for Hopkins, poetry is the sacrament of flesh, word, and spirit, charged by their interpenetration with each other. And more recently, Les Murray argued that the sacramental is the body. It's the mystery of embodiment, and words form a body called a poem. Yet Murray went further, advancing the idea of the poet as an offerer of sacrifice. His view of the poet as priest links him surprisingly with Jones. Unlike Jones, however, Murray does not stress the relationship between the representation of Christ's sacrifice in the Mass as the representation of a thing under another species, paint, clay, or language. For Murray, the poet is rather a speaker for the tribe who offers unbloody sacrifices. With respect to his own work, he spoke in specifically Christological terms. This quasi-priestly work of poetry is Christ for me. It's his life as I can live it by my best efforts. Like both Hopkins and Jones, each of whom also converted to Roman Catholicism in his early 20s, after his reception into the Catholic Church in 1964, the young poet was spiritually and intellectually riveted by the Church's principal ritual. He said in an interview many years later, "I identified with the Eucharist. I thought, yes, the absolute transformation of ordinary elements into the divine. I know about that. It didn't strike me as unlikely, and it opened up such illimitable prospects of life." Most secular mythologies seem to be anxious to close the possibilities of life down. This one opened out. The tenor of this statement closely resembles that of another that Murray made in an interview in 1998, where he addressed a more ideological reason for his conversion. As though in response to one critic who once aligned a dimension of his work, and by implication his faith, with pinched, unadorned belligerence and dogma, he stated, "My politics are anti-totalitarian. That's why I became a Catholic. It's for everybody. It may have a low opinion of sinners, but it's equally low of all. You're warned not to be proud, but also assured that you're of infinite worth." If it was an attraction to the Eucharist and to the inclusiveness of Catholicism that drew Murray to that faith, It was the work of Hopkins which principally, he said, turned him on to poetry and opened to him a dimension of the craft of poetry which many years later he linked with the Eucharist. He said that after reading Hopkins, he felt a bang. I suddenly discovered this language with a live electric current through it. I'd been casting around for an art form for a year or so. I'd gradually been moving away from military fantasies. I discovered that poetry was about presence. And I'll come back to that juxtaposition of violence, the military fantasies to which he refers, and presence throughout the talk. If poetry is about presence, so then, of course, is the Eucharist. And if the Eucharist is about the transformation of the ordinary into the divine, so too is poetry concerned with the interaction between the everyday and the absolute. Kevin Hart has noted that Murray sometimes follows what he calls an incarnational logic, in which, as Christ is both God and man, a poem is about the holy and the ordinary at once. Similarly, if the Eucharist stands against what Les called secular mythologies that close the possibilities of life down, so is poetry, in what he called the celebratory mode, characterized by what he said is a refusal of alienation and a species of humility. It's amazing how often these poets can't use that sacramental scholastic language of species, which doesn't presume to understand the world, at least never reductively, and so leaves it open and expansive with unforeclosed potentials. Yet while a poem may be open to unforeclosed potentials, it is also, he said, a very contained thing that holds down these tremendous energies. And these energies represent two opposed forces in his work: divine presence on the one hand, and what he said is the need for blood sacrifice on the other. And I quote, "Wait, human sacrifice? Surely that's an archaic horror that survives only very marginally in a few third world groups that anthropologists write about. Surely the Holocausts of this century," he means, of course, the 20th, "in what we call our civilization, can only be called human sacrifices in a very metaphoric sort of way. Surely there's a distinction to be made between the literal and the metaphorical. My answer is, there may be, but I don't know of one watertight enough to prevent the blood from seeping through it." A poem for Murray transforms the desire for sacrifice into a presence, as Christ on the cross is simultaneously the victim of the sacrifice and the offerer of his presence. A poem for Murray holds down both energies within itself. A poem, he says, which stays within the realm of literature completes the trinity of forebrain consciousness, dream wisdom, and bodily sympathy, of reason, dream, and the dance, without needing to embody itself in actual human suffering or action, and without the need to demand blood sacrifice from us. It is thus, like Christ's crucifixion, both effectual and vicarious. I mean, the point is not that we can prove any of this, of course, but that this is the way Les saw his work and saw what he was doing as participating in Christ's sacrifice on the cross. Elsewhere, the simile is reversed. He says Jesus is like a literal poem. Think about that, like a literal poem. Taking these terrible energies that sacrifice people, looking for significance to underline and stimulate it by giving it sacrifice, he's saying, God is saying, that's a superseded principle. I've taken that upon myself. It's all in here. Refer to this figure. It's contained. And Les concludes, "I'm always looking for the containment of human sacrifice." Believing that a desire for human sacrifice underpins human activity to varying degrees, Murray sets up an opposition between a resolved work of art, such as a poem, and disembodied idols, as he called them, which demand blood sacrifice to embody themselves. The need for sacrifice as such is either resolved in ritual or art or in actual human sacrifice. So what he does is to craft a poem which is a contemplative sight, the point into which human bloodlust is transformed into what he calls a never murderous skim distilled, and thus to show how it shares in a Eucharistic identity. In this way, it becomes both effectual and vicarious. If poetry symbolises for Murray the completion of his youthful journey away from military fantasies and marks a rejection of them, so the Eucharist is part of what he calls the Iliad of peace, which stands against and resolves what he calls in The Boys Who Stole the Funeral, the human sacrifice at the heart of literature. He said elsewhere, "The things I write about are mainly religious. I'm concerned with relations between human time and eternity at the odd points where they meet and illuminate each other, where matter becomes immortal or spirit enters time for a season." And I thought what I'd do is read from a poem from early in Murray's career, Once in a Lifetime, Snow, which seems to bear this out. The spirit entering time for a season. Winters at home brought wind, black frost, and raw grey rain in barbed wire fields, but never more, until the day my uncle rose at dawn and stepped outside to find his paddocks gone, his cattle to their hocks in ghostly ground, and unaccustomed light for miles around. And he stopped short and gazed, lit from below, and half his wrinkles vanished, murmuring, "Snow." A man of farm and fact, he stared to see the facts of weather raised to a mystery, white on the world he knew and all he owned. "Snow here?" he mused. "I see. High time I learned." Here, guessing what he meant had much to do with that black earth dread old men are given to, he stooped to break the sheer crust with delight at finding the cold unknown so deeply bright, at feeling it take his prints so softly deep, as if it thought he knew enough to sleep, or else so little he might seek to shift its weight of wintry light by a single drift. Perceiving this much, he scuffed his slippered feet and scooped a handful up to taste and eat, in memory of the fact that even he might not have seen the end of reality. Then turning, he tiptoed into a bedroom, smiled, and wakened a murmuring child and another child. The numinous snow, a fact of weather raised to a mystery, assumes by analogy some of the qualities of the Eucharist, where the bread and wine are raised to the mystery of Christ's body and blood in memory of Christ's passion. The farmer's response is similarly Eucharistic. He tastes and eats the snow in memory of the fact that reality exceeds the limits of material existence. Eating the numinous snow is the means by which the farmer physically responds to the spiritual dimension of what has taken place. He incorporates it into himself, both to taste and savour the experience, as well as its significance. While the phrase "in memory of the fact" recalls Christ's words, "Do this in memory of me," "taste and eat" also echoes part of the Eucharistic words of institution, "take and eat," and recalls the injunction in Psalm 33, "Taste and see that the Lord is sweet." And these connections, I think, are quite deliberate. by exceeding the limitations of reality as understood by the farmer, the event hints at the spiritual dimensions hitherto ignored by him, the unforeclosed potentials of the natural world. Eating the snow is the means by which that which had previously been beyond the imagination of the farmer, that which had been external to his vision, is incorporated into his imagination without thereby being exhausted by it. And it's significant too that the poem ends with him waking a murmuring child and another child. The kingdom of heaven is for such as these. The next poem I'll read from is from the same period in Murray's career, and it's called Blood. It's a very different poem. Pigs crowd in successive screaming pens, we still to greedy drinking, trough by trough. Tusk-heavy boars, fat mud-beslabbered sows, garn let him drink, you slut, you've had enough. Laughing and grave by turns, in milky boots, we stand and yarn and wet our butcher's knife. Sling cobs of corn, hey, careful of his nuts, it's made you cruel, all that smart city life. In paper spills we roll coarse, sweet tobacco. That's him down there, the one we'll have to catch, that little Berkshire with the pointy ears. I call him Georgie. Here, you got a match? The shadow of a cloud moves down the ridge. On summer hills, a patch of autumn light. My cousin sheathes in dirt his priestly knife. They say pigs see the wind. You think that's right? I couldn't say. It sounds like a fair motto. There are some poets. Right, he's finished now. Melon-sized and muscular, with shrieks, the pig is seized and bundled anyhow his twisting strength permits, then sternly held. My cousin tests his knife, sights for the heart, and sinks the blade with one long, even push. A wild scream bursts as knife and victim part and hits the showering heavens as our beast flees straight downfield, choked in his pumping gush that feeds the earth and drags him to his knees. Bleed, Georgie, pump! And with a long-legged rush, my cousin is beside the thing he killed and pummels it and lifts it to the sun. I should have knocked him out, poor little bloke. It gets the blood out if you let them run. We hold the dangling meat. Wet on its chest, the narrow cut, the tulip of slow blood. We better go. We've got to scold him next. Looking at me, my cousin shakes his head. What's up, old son? You butchered things before. It's made you squeamish, all that city life. Sly gentleness regards me, and I smile. You're wrong, you know. I'll go and fetch the knife. I walk back up the trail of crowding flies, back to the knife, which pours deep blood and frees sun, fence and hill, each to its holy place. Strong in my valleys, I may walk at ease. A world I thought sky lost by leaning ships in the depth of our life, I'm in that world once more. Looking down, we praise for its firm flesh, the creature killed according to the law. So the pig is an imperfect type of the true sacrifice, held aloft to the sun in a manner that recalls the elevation of the victim, or the host, in the liturgy. Like the snow in Once in a Lifetime, this meat will be eaten. And the idea of eating in response to revelatory moments as a means of reinforcing a sense of communion among individuals and the spiritual world figures strongly in Murray's sacramental vision. It becomes a prominent theme in poems like Towards the Imminent Days, which celebrates the sacrament of marriage, the union of lovers, which Les says will heal the 20th century. Set in a landscape of houses and loved fields all wearing away into heaven, it delights also in the earthy, hearty rituals of a country wedding. Champagne and chicken suppers, whiskey, pumpkins, calves, as the animal, human and divine realms, flesh, intellect, spirit, interconnect in a consciously incarnational celebration of love. Vindaloo in Mirtha Tydvil, which is a send-up or an affectionate send-up of Dylan Thomas in many respects, takes a humorous view of a mystical experience resulting from eating a hot curry. Instead of, Dylan Thomas's poem ends with, "I sang in my chains like the sea," and Les ends his, "I sang for my pains like the free." In Murray's work, natural food frequently parallels supernatural food, most famously in the Broadbean Sermon from his 1974 collection Lunch and Counterlunch. Here, the poet explores another of the oddest places where natural fecundity discloses its own inexhaustibility and invites the poet and us to explore the variety of the natural world. As the title suggests, the poem is concerned with the way in which the natural world can become an unassuming voice preaching to us. The title is partly ironic, for the first image the poet uses to describe the Broadbeans is that of a slack church parade without belief, saying, "Trespass against us," in unison. The image illustrates the way in which, at a first glance, the beans are a mass of seemingly indistinguishable vegetation. A slack church parade. Yet the ensuing succession of metaphors and similes belies this impression, as the poet is drawn deeper and deeper into the world that holds his attention, and deeper into his own imaginative and linguistic resources. In the second stanza, the broad beans are discussed as a collective initially, but from the fourth stanza until the conclusion, the poem explores the relationship between the universal you of the poem, who goes to pick the beans, and the inexhaustible diversity of the beans themselves. This plenitude keeps disclosing more and more variety and difference, which both the bean picker and the poet seek to rein in. The rapid succession of images is typical of Murray. At every hour of daylight appear more that you missed. Ripe, knobbly ones, fleshy-sided, thin, straight, thin, crescent, frown-shaped, bird-shouldered, boat-keeled ones, beans knuckled and single-bulged, minute green dolphins at suck. The idea that there are always more that you keep missing is important for Murray. The creation is inexhaustible. The divine plenitude that gave rise to it and that holds it in existence is inexhaustible. And for Murray, this is very important for understanding not only the dignity of the natural world, but more importantly, even for him, human dignity. That we can't be exhausted by any name, by any category that we're placed in. We remain unique. We should remain, be seen as unique to each other, and we are to God. In the first of his verse novels, The Boy Who Stole the Funeral, Murray draws heavily on Catholic sacramental images. The Eucharist, he calls food that solves the world. The idea of the world as a problem. The food that solves the world is the Eucharist. The poem describes an unlikely incident in which two friends, Kevin Forbutt and Cameron Reedy, sensing that Forbutt's uncle will not receive a proper burial, steal his body. It's also about one of the corporal works of mercy, isn't it? Burying the dead. The crime propels a series of adventures during which the protagonists confront their own inadequacies and approach spiritual enlightenment, recognizing the sacred in the everyday realities of work, family, and nature. Sacrifice is a dominant theme. Human sacrifice, which according to Murray takes many forms: war, murder, abortion, ritualized attacks on individuals by a mob. All of this he explicitly sets against God's sacrifice, the sacrifice he says, of the true God who gives his flesh and blood, as opposed to idols, false gods, who demand your flesh and blood off you. In one key episode, the boys pick up a hitchhiker who elaborates what is later referred to as his blood theology. It was all resolved once. This is my body, my blood. It's coming unsolved now. The work argues that it is not possible to ignore Christ's sacrifice without reverting to more ancient pagan forms of sacrifice, even if these are disguised in the modern age under the veil of progress. As Murray writes elsewhere, paraphrasing Chesterton, who lose belief in God will not only believe in anything, they will bring blood offerings to it. The question of sacrifice looms large in Murray's second verse novel, Freddie Neptune, from 1998. This tells the story of Freddie Borcher, a German-Australian sailor, who after witnessing the genocide of Armenian women at the hands of Turkish nationalists in 1917, loses feeling in his body, only to recover it when he learns to forgive his enemies. It is the poet's grand Homeric exploration of what he regards as the Enlightenment's disembodiment of humanity and the Christian alternative, the reception of a body, analogous to the reception of the Eucharist, which makes a person whole. The work forms a key part of Murray's career-long attempt to make sense of the relationship between poetry, religion, and ideology, and to find, which is sometimes difficult, meaningful distinctions between artistic, religious, and political efforts to map and make sense of experience. By an analogy evident throughout the book, the acceptance of Christ and the regaining of the body are linked with poetry, while totalitarian ideologies are linked with disembodied poems, spelt differently, P-O-E-M-E-S, which stand to true poetry as idols stand to the true God. After 265 pages of narrative divided into five books of eight-line stanzas, after he describes his journeys through the Middle East, Asia, North America, Europe, and Australia, through two world wars and the Great Depression, after having saved the lives of numerous people, either from accidents or from murderous regimes, after having worked in circuses, a strongman asylum, on Hollywood movies, on boats, on an airship, for corrupt politicians, for Banjo Patterson and Lawrence of Arabia, after having dined with Marlene Dietrich and spoken with Charlie Chaplin, after having been in more adventures than any comic book character, and finally, after having recovered feeling in his body, Fred concludes his story this way. Nothing would bring my null body back. It was gone forever. The limelight goes off me with it. We went on living. Joe got married next year, which filled his dimples with grins. Lou went to high school. I backed Norrie when I'd make extra cash, and some people picked I was different. Not up in your point shoes, Fred, as Ron asked me, getting back into his after the war. Later on we travelled. I paid to sleep, and people died of old age. But there's too much in life. You can't describe it. The theologian Michael G. Michael pointed out to me in a conversation about this passage many years ago that the last line, there's too much in life, you can't describe it, is reminiscent of the final words of John's Gospel. Jesus did many things. If one were to write them down one by one, the whole world, I believe, could not contain the books one would write about them. It is interesting to recall here Murray's words on the celebratory mode in poetry, characterized by what he calls a refusal of alienation, which doesn't presume to understand the world, at least never reductively, and so leaves it open and expansive with unforeclosed potentials. By deferring to silence, Fred defers to the example of the great apostle of the Incarnation, St. John. The work enacts the restoration of Fred's body, making it present, but it is the presence of individual mystery, restored to wholeness and completeness, and therefore, paradoxically, to that which is unforeclosed, contained but not reducible to its confinement in language or flesh. Like the farmer in once-in-a-lifetime snow, Fred realises that reality exceeds the limits even of his incredible experience. The text, the book, which has become his body, without which we would not know him and through which he exists, contains but does not limit the existence it maps, any more than the books of Scripture or the sacraments can limit the life of God. God remains an ungraspable trace, and yet he mediates his life through the textual, concrete, and particular facts of material existence. Art too, whether this book or any other, is inexhaustible because life is inexhaustible. This does not mean that the text has no relationship to life or that the text has no existence outside of itself. For as Murray writes elsewhere, nothing's true that figures in words only. On the contrary, it confirms such existence because it confirms that it derives its life from outside of itself, from grace, and mediates that life too as it receives it through the reader's touch. I've written out a new body that only needs a reader's touch, Murray writes in The Burning Want. Fred's humility before life's enormities, and what he describes in Freddie Neptune are actually enormities, the Holocaust and so on, his apophatic refusal to totalise by summary and generalisation set him apart from the purveyors of racial and class theory depicted in the book, whose poems burn women. What distinguishes Fred's response to illness from those who become murderers for a cause is Christ. Christ as God is the law against closure, the guarantee of diversity and the protector of individual integrity and worth. Fred acquires the internal authority of the Logos by agreeing to accept his body. With his body back, he is no longer like a disembodied and abstract concept, no longer a theory. The centre, as Murray said, is where any living thing is, and Fred becomes a centre by becoming a fully living thing. The centre of the world can no longer be understood exclusively as a geographical place, home, the city, or a nation. Rather, it becomes the personal integrity of the individual actualised in the combined workings of the dreaming and rational minds embodied in time and space. A key part of Fred's learning to pray with a single heart is learning that he is not beneath being a centre of the universe as an individual, nor beneath being a concrete realisation of God's poem that makes the centre complete and present at every point, including the periphery. Throughout the work, Fred always acknowledges and protects the rights of others to their place in life, writing them into his book of life. Unlike the communist Red Book, which the poem explores, and unlike Hitler's Mein Kampf, which the poet describes as Hitler's dead body that he'd enclosed my people in, it was Freddie's German. Freddie Neptune, both character and book, is alive. When Fred receives his body back and becomes fully himself, the silence that follows reveals that it is the very open-endedness of the work, representing humility, that places it within the divine economy articulated during one of his theological discussions. At speed, I asked, "What about it? God saving us? It's a promise. Buy it, and nobody's a failure. No one's book is closed." The book then is finished but not closed, for like any poem, it must be inexhaustible and complete, as Murray says in Poetry and Religion. And God, as Murray writes in the same poem, is the law against its closure, the one who cannot ultimately be quantified by the urge to transform the other into the self. He is thus in Christ the only answer, the only point of resolution who can be found everywhere. In accepting this, Fred places the Eucharistic sacrifice at the heart of his poem, a sacrifice that is human with the crucial difference that it is also divine. I'll finish there. I've only got up to 1998. Les lived another 20 years, so thank you.
Well, thank you, Stephen. What a way to begin 2021. There must be some questions or some comments, so I'll walk around the room with the microphone. No need to hold it. I'll hold it in front of the face of anyone who wants to ask or make any comments.
Stephen, you talked about, or you referred to, Les Murray's fascination with the military and with violence and so on, and I thought you sort of indicated you were going to talk about that. Could you just enlarge on that?
Yes, I probably could have been clearer. So when I was using that to foreshadow the discussion that came later about the role of violence as opposed to presence. But the military fantasies specifically that Les talked about was his desire as a young boy to go into the army, and he used to walk around the paddock with a gun, you know, shooting animals and so on. But there's a later poem of Murray's, I think from The Daylight Moon, in 1980, when did that come out? 1986, 87, called The Torturer's Apprenticeship, where he talks in darker terms about what might have happened to that boy walking around on the paddock. I mean, anyone who knows about Les knows that he later in life talked very much about his awful experience as a student, both at primary and high school, where he was bullied and so on. And the darker fantasy is the desire that a person who is bullied goes out and then takes revenge on their persecutors, or people who, as it were, stand in for their persecutors. So when he says he was searching for an art form to replace the military fantasies, he was conscious, even as a young man, that there was something dark, I suppose, about the desire to want to go in to war, the desire to go into a situation which would require you to kill people. So that's what he means. And he wasn't, you know, he was conscious of the reality of violence, even in our relationship with animals. You know, the relationship we have with animals, which, you know, farmers know is one of nurturing and caring, but also in many respects ultimately leading to our killing them. So he wasn't naive, but he saw that there were, you know, it's a part of life, that violence is unfortunately part of a fallen world, but that there is a, at least when it comes to violence of human beings against human beings, that there is an alternative. So that's, now in literature he talks about, you know, he uses this image in Animal Nativity, which is a poem in Translations from the Natural World in 1993, where he talks about the Iliad of Peace, which begins, it's about the Annunciation initially. The Nativity of Peace began when this girl agreed, referring to Our Lady. And the Iliad of Peace is, of course, opposed to the Iliad. He says that the first great poem in the Western canon is a poem of war. And he has this idea that all great epics are really in some way about war. That's true certainly of the Iliad. It's true of the Odyssey to a certain extent. I mean, Odysseus goes back and slaughters everyone. That's how it resolves. It's true of the Aeneid, which has that darker aspect, the Aeneid of the idea of civilization depending on, you know, conquest and blood ultimately. Paradise Lost is about a war, but the solution is different. And so the Iliad of Peace is the poem of Christ, which is the alternative to the Iliad of war.
Thanks so much, Stephen. For my taste, that was literary criticism at its most exciting best. Quite thrilling. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
It makes me want to really go back. In a way that I find reading Seamus Heaney's literary criticism, you really want to go back to those poets he talks about. Thank you. The later Murray. I have to say I've found him relatively unreadable. He's become so knotty, so gnomic, and given that you stopped in, I think, 1988, I'm interested if you could make some perhaps general comments on whether these same motifs and concerns lasted through to the end of his writing life.
Thanks, Jared. Les got smaller, in not physically, but Les got his poems got smaller and smaller. From about 2002, he wrote poems the size of photographs, and so he started to write a lot of epigrammatic poems. And the sort of middle length poems and the longer poems, they didn't disappear entirely, but they're not as much of a feature of the later books. I have to pull myself up here, because what I find with Les is often that it's not until 5 or 10 years after a book comes out that when I go back to it, I pick it up again and I find things in it which I didn't see initially. But yes, I think Taller Than Prone is probably a weaker book, which is one of the last. The Biplane Houses, yeah, they're not my favourite books. In terms of the... these ideas do keep recurring. He actually... I don't know if you know Marion Moore's famous poem called Poetry, which went from being, I think, 40 lines to being 3 lines. Well, Les reduced his verse novel, The Boys Who Stole the Funeral, to just a few lines, which appeared in collections in the 2000s. And it's that line, the true God gives his flesh and blood, idols demand yours off you. So this idea remained important to Les. And there are brilliant things in all his collections. But I don't know, he's not as inclined in the later years, in his interviews and so on, to talk about poetry in these terms. But he did do this from the very beginning. There's an interview he wrote a short piece for an anthology edited by Thomas Shapcott, which I think came out in the early 70s, where even then he's talking about poetry in these terms, in religious terms, not explicitly sacramental terms, but certainly that what he is a religious poet, and that his poems are about what God does for us, that he opens the world up for us, that no one's excluded. This is a really important idea of Les. He's against relegation. You know, he's against, at least in theory. I mean, we're all limited in our own ability to live that out. But he opposed relegation. He wanted to find a way for there to be something that included everyone. And he thought that Catholic Christianity was as close as you can get to that. But yeah. You use the word gnomic. I think that's probably true to some extent about the later poems. I find this with a lot of the major poets of that generation, including Heaney. Not that Heaney becomes gnomic, but that they're not as strong in the last 10 or 20 years. Derek Walcott is the same, and last, just a few months ago, the Irish poet Derek Mahon died, who's another one of my favourite poets, and I think his work declined too, probably in the last 20 years. But there are still things, I think, if you pick up a book by Les Murray, even the later works, even the weaker poems in his major works, major volumes, they're at a standard which is still, in my experience, not equaled by most other living poets. So even when he's not writing as well as he can, he's still writing better than most of us.
That's the trouble with doing so well when you're younger. It's very hard to keep up the standard, isn't it?
Yeah, but he did. I mean, Les got better, I think, for a period of about 30 years. He just got better and better. And he's constantly reinventing himself, which is what all great writers do.
You mentioned that Les became a Catholic in his early 20s. This happened when he left his rural and Presbyterian, I think, background, went to the city, married a Catholic. And in later life, he went back to where he came from. Do you know whether he got any pushback or disapproval from his family? I mean, they were a pretty tribal bunch, I think, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right. He became a Catholic when he married, or just before he married Valerie in the 1960s. He didn't go back to live permanently at Bunya until 1985, I think, 86, around then. I'm basing this really only on a few things I've read. Well, one is Peter Alexander's biography of Les, and the other is a memoir that I've just read in manuscript form by his friend and my friend, Jamie Grant. And from memory, I don't think that Cecil ever raised it as an issue. I don't know if it was a topic of conversation, but I don't know that I don't think he ever got pushback. You see, at the same time, you mentioned they were a tribal bunch. They were, and Catholics, of course, were much more so back then. That was fading then. But, you know, that tribalism generally in Australia, as you know, sectarianism declined rather than increased through the 60s and 70s and 80s. So, you know, I don't know that Cecil ever had an issue with it. I've never read anything to suggest that he did.
Stephen, at one point you said something about spirituality and place, and that set me in mind of Indigenous religiosity. And I can't think of... You'd know better than I, far better than I would. Did Les encounter that specifically that you can recall?
Well, he famously wrote a poem, The Bulladila Tari Holiday Song Cycle, which is based on an Aboriginal song cycle.
Mm.
And earlier than a lot of other writers, he was championing the cause of Indigenous rights, including land rights, very early on. For many years, believed that he had he did have an Aboriginal cousin, Vicky, who coincidentally, whose house I lived in without knowing it at the time in Canberra. I rented a house when I was a student in Canberra, and found out later, Alan Gould, the Canberra poet, we were out once having a drink, and he dropped me home, and he said, "You know, that's Les's cousin's house that you're living in." I had no idea. So anyway.
So you were fated.
Les has an Indigenous cousin, but for many years I think Les was of the belief that he had Indigenous ancestry, but I think that was disproved. I think he had at least genetically disproved. I think culturally, there's some truth in that.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your very interesting and wonderful talk. I wanted to ask you. You said Les Murray. Sort of thought in terms of the divine and the ordinary. Do you think there's any connection between Teilhard de Chardin's work, The Hymn of the Universe, with that type of poetry and thought?
I don't know I know de Chardin, of course. I know who he is, who he was. I don't know. I couldn't comment specifically. And I don't know that Les ever explored those sort of ideas, you know, the idea of evolving towards Christ. So I wouldn't like to comment without knowing the poem. But
thanks, Stephen.
Hi, Jenny. How are you?
Wonderfully suggestive, terrific piece.
Thank you.
I'm particularly interested in what you were saying, really, about the law of closure and the way in which that relates to the openness, the unfinalizability, the infinitude. And that was making me think a bit about his distinctive poetic voice and style. An unmistakable voice. It's nothing like Les, I think. Mm. And quite often you feel there's a kind of breathlessness. And, if you hear him reading his poems, it's there, isn't it, in the voice, as though he's making a kind of almost perfunctory grab at something, you know, as though it shuts down. All that needs to be said has been said. And then the way in which that then opens out into this marvellous sacramental process of the kind you're describing. Would you make that sort of connection with his style, do you think, and his voice?
Yes, I think in a way it's the same. It's reflected in the need to begin another poem. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's always, you know, something's contained, but then you've got to go and do it again. You know, it's the same with... I mean, with the exception, if you read The Desert Fathers, there's a story of Mary of Egypt who famously only received the Eucharist once in her life, you know, and she was this hermit in the desert. And I think in the sayings of The Desert Fathers, the elder Zosima, who is a priest, was praying and has a vision where God says to him, you know, there's someone holier than you, and you go and see her. And he goes out and he gives her, he was a priest, and gives her communion. But with the exception of Mary of Egypt, the Eucharist is a sacrament that is repeated, isn't it? And the reception of the Eucharist needs to be repeated. So even though, in a sense, one encounter of that kind is could be all-consuming, if you think about what happens, nonetheless, we need to keep doing it again. And so, as in the Broadbean sermon, each image seems correct. Minute green dolphins that suck and all the other images. And yet, they all capture the reality, but they don't exhaust the reality. So there's always more to say. There's always more, as he says, that escape your notice. And so, yes, the image is as he says in Poetry and Religion, caught but not imprisoned. Caught but not imprisoned. And that's reflected in the idea of, you know, that God is truly present, body, blood, soul and divinity in the Eucharist, but at the same time not contained by the Eucharist, not exhausted by the Eucharist. So, yes, the better a poetic image, the more it captures the reality of the thing, but it doesn't exhaust the reality. And in fact, that's the gift, I think, is to point to the fact that you've captured it, but that it's escaping you at the same time. Yeah. So it's, what's the image? I think it occurs in the Roman Rite as well, but in the Eastern Liturgy, there's this saying, that which the whole world cannot contain is contained in your womb, O blessed Theotokos, God-bearer. So that which the whole world cannot contain is contained. So that's the paradox, I think, of the Incarnation and of the Eucharist.
Christabel, I know exactly what you mean when you talk about hearing Les read. I mean, I sometimes think that he's the poet of the obituedicta, the little side set out of the corner of his mouth, and you suddenly think, hey, wait a minute, he said something very important there, and it's gone. But he said he was exactly like that when he was reading it. He always, laconic, eh, Murray, I sometimes think. It's all laconic and it's all profound at the same time. It's quite extraordinary.
Do you know that poem, Bat's Ultrasound, where he... I'll see if it's here. It is here, but I'll... And this point goes to what you were saying, Jenny, that there's no one else who could have written this. He says, sleeping bagged in a duplex wing with fleas in rock cleft or building, radar bats are darkness in miniature. Their whole face one tufty crinkled ear with weak eyes, fine teeth bared to sing. Few are vampires, none flit through the mirror. Where they flutter at evenings, a queer tonal hunting zone above highest sea. Insect prey at the peak of our hearing, drone re to their detailing tea. Ah, irie, irie, ero, our a, our or area, our era, I, ear, your, raw, row, we air our ray, ear, your, row, rye, aura, our orary, our irie, oo, our ray, our arrow, a rare ear, our airy Yahweh. So it's, you know, Bat's Ultrasound, we can't hear it, but God, who created them, through him all things were made, can and does it for his own delight and pleasure, and has this rare ear, our airy Yahweh, which is beautiful.
Just a little comment. I'm impressed by the degree to which this focus on the infinitude in the created is countercultural. And it just popped into my mind the fact that certain very, very eminent modern scientists are searching for what they call a theory of everything. It seems to me to be the exact opposite of what Murray is on about.
Yes, a theory that exhausts everything, right? That explains everything. I don't know enough about science to know exactly what they are looking for. But it seems almost self-evident that such a theory would be defeated as soon as something notices anything that doesn't fit into it. But yeah, I think I think he would be opposed to that.
Stephen, I think there are quite a few people in this room who knew Les when they were students and probably didn't take him as seriously as we all do now. In fact, it's a reminder that we probably don't take most things seriously when we're young and experience them. And what Les was doing in writing about the ordinary become extraordinary might be a salutary thing for us all, to think that we all know people who are extraordinary in what they do or what they are, what they represent, and we don't take them very seriously when we know them. And whether that's an Australian characteristic or not, I don't know. I can't think of any better way of encapsulating what we've experienced today than what Jared had to say. It was literary criticism elevated to a level which is what I often say: all art is moral activity, and we've just seen that exemplified today. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
I might say that next month we're going to have another potentially extraordinary presentation. We're going to have Mark Dunn come and talk about his most recent book on the Hunter Valley, the Convict Valley, and its extraordinary role in Australia's history. And that I recommend. I recommend that you have a look at the book. But I first met Mark when he joined Infusion of Young Blood, as it were, into the working party of the Australian Australian Dictionary of Biography. There are other historical institutions besides ACTHS, of course. And it's a remarkable book, so I strongly recommend that you come. Come in large numbers, because unless things take a turn for the worse, as things stand, we're told that we don't have to register anymore. The wearing of masks in meetings like this is now not mandatory. It may be advisable or may not. So please feel free to come yourselves in large numbers. Invite everybody who wants to come to hear Mark Dunn talk, and we hope that we'll be able to offer afternoon tea as well next month. So those who come for the afternoon tea and the coffee conversation, the cafe clutch, let them come in large numbers as well. So thank you all very much for coming. I think that that it indicates that we're in for a very good year, at least in these occasions. Thank you very much again, Stephen.
You've been listening to a talk given to a meeting in Sydney of the Australian Catholic Historical Society on the 21st of February 2021, entitled Les Murray's Sacramental Poetics. The speaker was Dr. Stephen McInerney, poet and Executive Officer Academic of the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization, Sydney. Dr. John Carmody moderated the Q&A session which followed the talk. A version of this talk will be published in a forthcoming issue of the Journal of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. This podcast was produced for the Society by me, John Kenny. We hope you can join us for Dr. Mark Dunn's talk in March 2021, The Intimate Frontier, Aboriginal and Settler Interactions in the Colonial Hunter Valley. Until then, stay safe.